Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Nancy MacLean. Her award-winning and provocative book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, will be out in paperback June 5th. And let me tell you that after a three-year hiatus, with the election of Donald Trump, I couldn't resist exploring the path forward in new interviews. So this is the 28th such interview. I do one about every 2 weeks. Paul Hawken on climate change. Naomi Klein on her book, No Is Not Enough. David K. Johnston on the daily dirty work of the Trump administration, that sort of thing. And the show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts, of course, are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my own site, TerrenceMcNally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally.net. And before I bring her in, let me offer you a few websites for information on how to participate in resistance to the Trump agenda and also the work forward toward the healthy, just future we all need. And you can email me if you want some more background on some of this, T.E. McNally, again, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. So these six websites, Indivisible Guide, one word, indivisibleguide.com, probably the most comprehensive national organization with about 5,000 local groups. OurRevolution.com, again, one word, OurRevolution.com, which grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. MoveOn.org and Courage Campaign, one word, CourageCampaign.org. Those are two organizations that have been primarily digital activists for most of their time, but over the last couple of years have linked themselves more closely with grassroots work as well. MoveOn.org is national. Courage Campaign is for the state of California. And finally, two very specific ones that can lead you to specific actions. Five Calls, that's the number 5, C-A-L-L-S, fivecalls.org, tells you timely calls that you might want to make to your representatives about issues and legislation that's happening right at the time. And Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, which tells you when local representatives might be holding constituent meetings in your area for you to attend. Now to today's guest. I've made the point since at least the 2000 election that the right and the GOP have seen that politics and elections played fair and square are not moving in their direction. And so they have turned to strategies and tactics that make it possible for them to gain power greater than their ideas or their candidates would otherwise merit. Gerrymandering, voter suppression, the refusal to act on Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. You can see how these things play out. You can see there's a playbook. Well, today's guest cites a source for that strategy that prior to her latest book, I suspect a lot of people, myself included, had never heard of. Most books about today's radical right, most thinking about today's radical right, begin with the Powell Memo, or Ayn Rand, or the Koch brothers. Well, in Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, Nancy MacLean tells a new story of a Nobel Prize-winning economist whose ideas fuel the right's relentless campaign to eliminate unions, suppress voting, privatize public education, change the Constitution, and curb Democratic majority rule. James McGill Buchanan, not a household name, but she lays out his crucial role in designing the mechanisms by which the Koch brothers would eventually fund a new radical right, with aims of disabling the democratic process in favor of free-reign capitalism. MacLean claims Buchanan created the blueprint that ultimately made Koch money so effective. Nancy MacLean, William Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University, is the author of Behind the Mask of Chivalry, The Making of the Second Ku Klux Klan, Freedom is Not Enough, The Opening of the American Workplace, and her latest, due in paperback June 5th, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. Welcome, Nancy MacLean, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, May 8th, 2018.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Terrence, and thank you for that wonderful setup.
Okay, good, good. So, how, before we get into this book, how would you tell the story of your personal path to the work you find yourself doing today?
Oh my gosh, it was quite the winding path. There was so much serendipity in it. I've actually had a reader who came to a book talk who wrote me a note listing all of the kind of coincidences that went into my discovery of what I report in the book. So I can just say that when I started the research that ultimately became this book, it was 2006, and at that point I'd never heard of either James McGill Buchanan or Charles Koch, the two people who loom largest in the story I tell.
Let me break in for 1 second.
Researching the story of the state of Virginia's leadership of the wider South to massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education using privatization as a strategy.
Let me break in for 1 second and say we've got an hour, and okay. I'd like people to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas. So I'm saying not just your path to this book and how...
I see what you're saying.
Your path,
oh, gotcha.
Yeah. In other words, when I see a book about the Ku Klux Klan, or, you know, a book... What was your... You know, what's been the thread? What have been the twists and turns? And then we'll get into the coincidences leading up to this one.
Good. Okay. Well, so I have long been, always since I was a sentient adult, been someone who is interested in social justice and social change. And I saw my occupational contribution to that as lying in the realm of history. So went to graduate school in the 1980s. And when I went to graduate school, at that period, that was the time when the moral majority was surging in our politics. And I was also in a program in women. Women's history, trying to understand the significance of gender in our national past. And so the book that you mentioned on the Ku Klux Klan came out of that conjunction of this period of, you know, a massive new organizing project centered on what, you know, they like to call family values, and my discovery in the archives that the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s had built on a similar kind of outreach, really emphasizing its role as a force for moral purity and, as they put it, cleaning up communities. So that was the first book, and I would say that's kind of an example of how my work has evolved ever since. There was an Italian historian, now deceased, called Benedetto Croce, who once said that all history is contemporary history, and by that he means that, of course, the past is past, but we bring to it our questions that are shaped by the world we're trying to understand, and all my work has been done in that vein. So after I finished that book on the Ku Klux Klan, my next book, Freedom is Not Enough, was essentially a social and political history of affirmative action in the workplace. And that came out of a moment in the 1990s when figures like David Duke, sadly back in the news now, the Ku Klux Klan leader, were campaigning against affirmative action as kind of the entering wedge of their push to build a white nationalist force in the U.S., and I was finding, you know, I had students coming to me saying, but where did affirmative action come from? You know, how do we answer these things? Mm-hmm. And when I went to look at the sources, there really was nothing good out there, and so I thought, well, I'll write a book. So that became Freedom is Not Enough, with a particular focus on workplaces, because I was also seeking with that to break through this silly, stale, and misleading debate between class politics and identity politics, and help people understand how class politics have always been identity politics, and identity politics have always been concerned with material issues because of the way the groups affected by them were excluded from full citizenship. So, I mean, I could go on and on,
well,
but
you
that's
know what?
Kind
I'm
of
gonna...
the gist of it. And I can say with this latest book, perhaps the last thing I'll say is A Democracy in Chains came out of a moment in which it was clear that the American political right was really pushing to undermine public education and to promote privatization of our schools. And as I sought to understand that with a new story I'd found in the archives, I ended up on this path that ultimately led me to the Koch donor network and to the ways it's weaponized James Buchanan's ideas.
And let me ask you, I'm going to ask you two questions. One is, how did your move to North Carolina in 2010 influence this? And then my second one, because I sometimes remember to ask this of folks who work in a university situation. You've told us about the evolution of your work in books. What do you teach, and what have you noticed about your interactions with students regarding all of this along your path? So the first one is just your move mm-hmm. to North Carolina, and then a little bit about relations with students.
Yeah, actually, I do not think that I could have written the book that I did had I not moved to North Carolina in 2010. And I joke that I really should have given credit to the GOP-dominated General Assembly here for helping me understand all of this. Because what happened is I moved here in August, I guess it was, of 2010 from Chicago, where I'd been for 20 years. And that fall, this Koch-funded, Tea Party-driven, Red Map-produced new majority in the Project Red Map-produced new majority in the both houses of the North Carolina General Assembly was a historic transformation. And there had not been Republican control over the legislature here since the days of Reconstruction. And North Carolina actually had one of the only coups to overthrow that Republican majority because it was it involved African Americans and racial and economic justice. So this was a real transformation. And as soon as this legislature set to work, it began a program of what its biggest donor called Big Bang changes.
Wow.
Transforming everything from public worker rights to the unemployment system to environmental protection to reproductive rights to gerrymandering to voting. I mean, I could just go on and on. It goes on to pages. And meanwhile, at the same time, Scott Walker had been elected governor of Wisconsin, where I had gone to graduate school. And Scott Walker was, as he put it, dropping the bomb, right,
wow.
to take away the rights of public sector workers. So in these two locales I understood intimately and cared deeply about, I could see this project rolling out. And at that point, I was still focused on another story, but I was trying to understand Buchanan's ideas. And I realized that what I was seeing abstractly in his scholarly work mm-hmm. was what was happening concretely in front of my eyes in North Carolina and in Wisconsin. So
for listeners,
did a deep dive into more of his work and finally got access to his personal archives, which confirmed my hypotheses. As far as the students, it's been really interesting to see how things are changing now. I mean, and Duke was a pretty progressive campus before. I think Obama had, won like 85% of the vote here in 2008 and maybe about that, I think, actually, in 2012. But I wouldn't say it was a very active campus. It was interesting to hear your opening to the show in which you talked about Indivisible and Our Revolution and all these other groups that have become so active since the election in 2016. And I'm seeing a somewhat analogous thing happening here. I teach a variety of courses, but the one that's most directly relevant is a history of social movements in the U.S., and I just submitted my grades yesterday. But I just had an amazing group and a full house, and they were just so interested and eager and engaged with the issues, and I think it's because they've been profoundly politicized by what's going on in the country, and they're really seeking to understand where that came from, but also how progressive social change happens.
Oh, that's excellent to hear. And let me just mention that the two states that you have your experience and you point out have turned, Wisconsin is one of the birthplaces of progressive politics and
yes.
and had always been, a place where there was leadership on progressive and liberal causes. And North Carolina, my family lives in Atlanta, Georgia. My brother mm-hmm. went to Duke. I spent some time there with him. This is many years ago. But the Terry Sanfords, the Harvey
yeah.
Gantz, it was probably the most progressive Southern state for much of the last 50 years. So these are places where, and when you see, as you point out, the Republican get their takeover in 2010. I consider the dropping of the ball by the Obama administration of nationalizing that campaign as you know, prior to the selection of districts following, you know, the 2010 census as one of the great, great failures of yeah. that administration. I mean, with repercussions for years to come. But as you point out, they hit the ground running so fast, so hard, boom, nuclear, you know, that I can see where you go, wait, there's somebody's given them a playbook. There's something
exactly.
going on here. So take
exactly.
it from there.
Yeah, well, so I'm really glad that you drew attention to the prior history of those two states, Wisconsin and North Carolina, because I see them as very similar in some ways that you've suggested. And I think it's really important for your listeners to recall, too, that Wisconsin's progressive tradition was bipartisan. You know, Robert La Follette, who was a great progressive leader in Wisconsin, was a Republican mm-hmm. Back in the day. And that whole notion of the Wisconsin idea of having public education, particularly higher education, in the service of the state for its economic development and democratization and enlightenment. That was a bipartisan idea in Wisconsin for years, and the state university system was the pride of both parties. And, you know, there's so many things to be disturbed at by Scott Walker's administration, but one of them is his deliberate and calculated efforts to undermine the state higher education system to the point that now even some Republican business leaders who supported him have raised their voices at the horror and the recklessness of it. But one element of that is he actually tried to get rid of the statement of the Wisconsin idea in the university mission, right, of the university's public mission to the state. And I just think that is so telling. And sadly, now that Walker has conquered, you know, power in the state and they've undermined public sector unions, passed voter suppression, done all these other things, it supported a constitutional convention, state-convened constitutional convention, which we might talk about later.
Oh, we will.
Another thing that they have done is in North Carolina, similar thing, as you say, North Carolina was a beacon to the South of a kind of moderate, enlightened progressivism over the course of the 20th century. You know, it certainly had its flaws, but it was a model to the South because it had begun as a very poor and not well-endowed state, unlike its neighbors, but through strategic, smart public investment in good schools and roads and all the rest of it, they brought North Carolina, you know, out on the top of a model to the rest of the South and a really exciting place. And now that we have this Tea Party, you know, style Republican General Assembly governing us for several years, they are boasting of making North Carolina a laboratory for the right, and they now have us competing with Mississippi in our education funding or lack thereof, you know, and in many other measures. So it is really, really a sad state of affairs. And going back to your original framing of the show, we would not be seeing this if these people campaigned openly on what they were trying to achieve and if they did not rig the rules in their favor through gerrymandering, voterish suppression, and all the rest.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, I'm not the only one, I'm sure, who will take it back to the Gore v. Bush decision by the Supreme Court, which then changes the presidency, which then changes the Supreme Court itself, which then brings in all of the Federalist Society, you know, judges around the country,
right.
And so on, where these things, you know, you go back and you can see these points where their strategy and their success with that strategy has turned things, as I say, where they are a minority party with mm-hmm. a phenomenal majority advantage in state legislatures and
yeah.
at least a majority that is under threat in the national legislatures.
Right. They now have, and it bears, you know, underscoring for listeners, they now have control of 30 states, where the Democrats have 6, and they have control over all 3 branches of government. And I don't know if you've been following the recent exposures from George Mason, which is a big focus of my work, the
yes.
Koch Academic Base Camp set up there. But among those exposures, since you mentioned the Federalist Society, were we're through FOIA releases, were findings that the Federalist Society was operating through a shell group, a front group of the kind used to launder money, sending money into the George Mason, now called Scalia School of Law, with all kinds of purposes that are not normal in higher education, including having sway over faculty appointments and student placements, and basically trying to populate the right-wing judicial universe with students and faculty from George Mason. So it's really a deep corruption, poisoning even, of public higher education that they're involved in. And it's fascinating that the Federalist Society, which, as you say, has been the key vetting mechanism for right-wing judicial appointments going back to Reagan, that the Federalist Society is right in the middle of it with a front group. Now, you don't set up a front group, a legal front group, unless you're doing something nefarious, right?
Right. You don't need
so
one.
So this is highly revealing and extremely important to follow.
Yeah. Okay, so you say that the radical rights playbook was designed decades ago, and I've long, as I said in the introduction, associated that with the Powell memo released by Lewis Powell in the summer of 71, 2 months before Nixon nominated him to serve in the Supreme Court. And before I pick up the book, is what am I missing? And that is, now you can take on the story of how this book happened.
So what are you missing if you just know about the Powell memo?
Right.
Is that the, yeah. So the Powell memo is really important, and that's why, of course, it's gotten all the attention that it has, and so many people know about it. But the Powell memo is really only the tip of the iceberg, right? And it's a kind of a late mechanism in all this. And one interesting thing to know about it is that the Powell memo is produced about, I'd say a third of the way into my story that in Democracy in Chains, and it's of interest because Lewis Powell was then was in the point of the in Virginia during the fight against Brown. He was the head of the Richmond School Board, and so he was deeply involved in some of what was going on in the state then. But he was also asked to write that memo by a figure at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce who had himself created earlier something called the Virginia Commission on Constitutional Government to fight back against the New Deal and the Civil Rights Movement. And you could say that what Powell was doing was a kind of an extension of that in response to the upheaval of the 60s and 70s. So that Powell memorandum is really important, in how it encouraged business mobilization, how it represented the capitalist system as under profound threat from dissent and from social movement organizing, consumer movement, and so forth, and how it laid out a kind of blueprint for corporate mobilization in defense of the kind of capitalism that they wanted to see thrive. So it's very important, but it also did not lay out anything like a strategy for how to shackle democracy.
Right.
So that's where Buchanan's work really came in. You know, I would say that certainly he shared goals with Powell and was part of the same broad milieu, but what Buchanan was trying to do was really think strategically about how the 20th century liberal state developed, and by that I mean things like regulation of corporations in the progressive era, workers' rights and social insurance in the New Deal, anti-discrimination, in the 1960s, and environmental legislation thereafter. Buchanan looked at how collective action had enabled all that to develop in a certain set of constitutional rules, and he focused laser-like on how to undo all that by first undermining the collective power in the way that we saw with Scott Walker dropping the bomb in Wisconsin. That would be an example of that. But then radically revising the rules at every step to take away the incentives for elected officials to listen to their constituents, right?
Yeah.
And to also handicap those constituents in making their own voices heard in a whole variety of ways, but most obviously voter suppression and gerrymandering. So Buchanan actually tried out out his vision for an economic constitution in Chile, where he was invited in 1980 by the Pinochet dictatorship, and he advised on something that came to be known as the Constitution of Liberty, and that Constitution of Liberty is still shackling elected officials in Chile and preventing them from reversing things that the dictatorship did, such as privatizing Social Security, privatizing the education system in a way that made Chilean higher education the most expensive in the world, and more. The recent president, Michelle Bachelet, was elected by two-thirds of the Chilean people on a wide-ranging reform program to deal with all of that. And she found that she couldn't because of what she called the locks and bolts in the Chilean constitution. And those locks and bolts, I found in my research, were urged by James Buchanan.
Okay. And let me provide a little historical context. There may be some listeners who do not realize that the Nixon administration was where the OSHA was enacted, occupational safety, where the EPA was enacted. There was talk even then of a guaranteed national income. And what had happened was the U.S. consensus, if you will, had moved so much that Nixon would now be, I think, or at least prior to the Trump election, would have been on the left side of the Democratic Party at this point. Mm-hmm. Things have moved again where that might not be the case. But just so folks, when this surge from the right through Powell and then, as you point out, Buchanan's gives more strategy and tactics to Powell's approach. It grew out of them looking and seeing, wait a minute, the people, even with Republicans in power, the people just have too much influence. Now...
And I'm glad that, can I just say, I'm glad that you brought attention to Nixon and what was happening in the 1970s with this, because that is exactly the point when Buchanan... and his, in particular, began to urge organizing a counterintelligentsia, as he called it. And now some people know that William Simon did that later in the decade, but Buchanan was there in the beginning working with Ed Meese, who was then Ronald Reagan's chief advisor when Reagan was governor. And it's precisely because they were seeing not just the stuff happening on the left and in the campus revolt in those years and in the labor movement, but just what you described.
The incentives
of politics were leading even a Nixon to support the EPA, OSHA, guaranteed annual income, et cetera. So that's when Buchanan and a number of more, sort of far-sighted people who were really playing a long game and thinking, decades or even generations ahead, they said, we have to stop this, right? And the only way we're going to stop this is by changing the rules, ultimately, but also in the interim, building an infrastructure. And so Buchanan called for building a counterintelligentsia, and he was quite clear with funders and with allies that that would require, as he put it, a gravy train. They would have to get donors to invest a ton of money to create the incentives to lure these men, and they talked about them as men in that period, into the libertarian cause, to create all these organizations and to have a vision of over decades changing the national conversation and changing the national rules. And they were very, very effective in that. And Buchanan worked with just about every one of those organizations, many of them now funded by Koch, including, well, Cato was started by Koch, the Cato Institute.
It was originally,
The Federalist Society, which also was developed with Koch seed money, the Independent Institute. You know, you could go on the huge organizational infrastructure they built up, but that is what is moving the agenda now. And you could say even more so in the states, perhaps, than in the nation through a group called the State Policy Network.
Right. I was going to say one thing, that the Cato Institute's, its original name was the Charles Koch Foundation, correct?
Yes.
It was only later that they decided that wasn't such a good idea. Now, Buchanan, you're attributing all of this strategy to him and influence to him. He originally is an economist, and he's a Nobel Prize winning economist, and public choice theory is one of his big fields. Talk about that.
Sure, but let me first share an irony. I'll do a little spoiler alert here, but the end of my story shows that how instrumental this Koch network is in the way it treats everyone, including those on whom it relies most profoundly. So they actually elbowed Buchanan to the side
right.
at his home institution, George Mason University, in the late 1990s when he raised questions about how nakedly political their operation was that they were building on the campus and how bereft of academic involvement and support. So I think that that is an irony. So Buchanan, even though he developed the core ideas and vision and many of the mechanisms, he was not at the forefront of the final rollout of all of this in the new century. But what happened is that Charles Koch and the various operatives closest to him and architects of all of this, what they did was to weaponize Buchanan's ideas to do what they were doing. But so I just want to make that, that slight distinction because I think it's both interesting and important.
The other thing I can see in your irony is that Buchanan was not just an operative. He was not just a bottom line person. He was also an academic. And so he laid it out. But when they began to sort of destroy the institution of the university, he drew the line. He was discarded.
Very, very well put. Absolutely. And in fact, I know from someone inside, I didn't put this in the book, but he was actually appalled that the Koch network was using their political party, the Republican Party, and their control over governmental institutions to move this agenda, so which was a violation of his thinking, right? So their crudity in pushing for radical change in this manner, I think, and who can be certain? He died in 2013,
right.
But I think would have offended Buchanan, too, and I have reason to think from people close to him that that is, in fact, the case.
Okay, so let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Nancy McLean. She's the author of the award-winning and provocative book, and when I say award-winning, the one that I just saw most recently was the LA Times, which has their book festival every April, and they give awards, Democracy in Chains, the book we're talking about, its award in, was it in Current Events?
Current Interest, yes.
Yeah, Current Interest, which is a big deal. That's their
yes.
book of the year in Current Interest. And the book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. And it's out in paperback June 5th. So public choice theory, he settles on, I mean, what's interesting is that he basically, I mean, human self-interest has been a pretty foundational principle of economics. And he applies it to government in such a way that if you follow it, it sort of unsettles your view of government and provides a wonderful foundation for the right's strategies after that. So talk about that.
Yeah, okay, so Buchanan was trained at the University of Chicago, which a lot of your listeners will know is like the citadel of free market fundamentalist economics in the United States. But what he did that was different from these people with whom he was broadly in agreement was to focus not on the market, but on the government and public institutions of all kinds. And he would actually tell these right-wing funders and corporations in seeking their contributions to his academic centers that he saw what he was doing as more fundamental. Because if you only made the case for the market, but everybody knows that there's market failure, right, and problems with the market, people would naturally look to government to remedy those and to fix them. And what Buchanan wanted to do was, in a sense, take that option off the table or at least tarnish it so much that people would really think twice before looking to government for anything. And the way that he did that was, just as you say, to in his terms, apply economic analysis to political actors. But it was an economic analysis unlike, say, Marx or Charles Beard or many others, in that what he was applying was Chicago and Austrian-style assumptions to say, that these political actors could only be understood as individuals, right? There's no meaningful groups in this analysis, so they weren't representing a class. They weren't, you know, race men, as civil rights activists used to be called. They weren't feminists. No, no, no. Everybody in public life was only seeking their own personal self-interest, and in his terms, particularly a kind of venal self-interest. So for elected officials, he would say that their self-interest was in getting reelected and therefore making promises to multiple constituencies to be paid for by taxes raised from others. You could say union officials only interested in expanding their dues base, you know, on and on. Agency officials, you know, expanding their fiefdoms. So this was his analysis. I think it's really important to point out that when he created this, he was not at all an empirical researcher. In other words, he had no information about people's motives in public life, but it was all done through game theory, you know, through elaborate speculation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But it was very persuasive to many people because game theory was a kind of a hot thing. And it got a lot of purchase on the right because it said things that people that were very helpful. And important to those people. And, you know, and I will say, too, I mean, I think it did yield some interesting hypotheses, like it's reasonable to ask if somebody has a personal stake in what they're pushing forward. But the problem with it as a whole school of thought is that it is so toxic in its assumptions about people's behavior and about the very nature of public life that it leads to the kind of toxic dump of cynicism that we see in the Trump era, mm-hmm. you know, where people in, you know, where the president doesn't care about facts, doesn't care about the realities of policies, doesn't care about anything, because the whole enterprise has been, you know, ideologically undermined with these ideas of makers and takers in the swamp and so forth. Mm-hmm. So you could say at one point his ideas had an interesting heuristic value. Over time, they really hardened into a kind of dogma. And that dogma is really undermining our capacity for collective self-government at this point in our history.
Yeah, and I would look, as I'm thinking about it, as I've thought about it over the last few days, we can see absolutely the appeal of his theories to folks who are looking to decrease the power of the people, the power of the government, and increase the power of their own corporations. What's interesting is I can also imagine it having an appeal to young people, that is to say, young students. Self-interest, when you are a college student and you've gotten out of being ruled by your parents and you're about to get out of college and not be ruled in loco parentis and so on, and you are about to, I think Nietzsche and these sorts of philosophies have a great deal of appeal. Do you agree?
That's interesting. Buchanan had a notebook where he liked to keep various kinds of quotations, and he was a great fan of Nietzsche.
Sure.
It's just anecdotal information. But I think, you know, certainly there's a lot of cynicism among young people and a lot of distrust. I mean, there is in the wider population at this point about government. And so I think that would play. And I think a lot of people, young people, feel a kind of instinctual libertarianism, mm-hmm. you know, which I get. I mean, who wants to go to prison for smoking pot, you know, or, you know, have the U.S. military able to go to any country without question and without response to impose U.S. power. You know, there's a lot that you can understand in the appeal of, a certain elementary strain of libertarian ideas. The problem is, though, that this libertarianism as funded by Koch through this whole apparatus of institutions has, as I said, congealed into a deadly dogma, and the best evidence of that, or the most obvious evidence, is their funding of climate science denial.
Sure.
When we only have a limited amount of time to deal with the challenges to our planet. And the other thing they're doing that speaks directly to your point about young people is they're actually trying to incite a kind of generational class conflict between younger people and retirees. Mm-hmm. And they fund a group called Generation Opportunity, which is one example of this. And some co-funded professors at George Mason actually said at the time of Occupy Wall Street that the people occupying Wall Street should be occupying the AARP instead, as though our problem is not Wall Street. It's a bunch of greedy grandmas and grandpas, right, who are bilking the public through Social Security and Medicare.
Yep.
So it's a really, once you get into this stew of ideas, it's kind of astonishing.
Right.
And, you know, and I think this circles back to the original framework with which you set up our conversation, which is that these ideas would be nowhere without the money, the at this point, billions of dollars being invested in them in this country and on a world scale through something called the Atlas Network. But it is, you know, crucial that people understand the ideas, where they're coming from, and how they have achieved this influence if there's going to be any hope of combating them.
Yeah. Now your book, when it came out, and it came out in 2017, what month?
June.
Okay. Almost a year ago, and paperback coming out, as I said, June 5th. You were attacked, your book and you were attacked by the right. And we may have time to go into that, but we may not. But what I wanted to say was one of the things that was raised was I'm going to paraphrase, but Buchanan is an economist. He had economic theories. McLean is making him a strategist and a tactician and an advisor to the Republican Party and blah, blah, blah. You know, she's taking a reach. And what you one of the things you point to is the document that Buchanan wrote providing the Cato Institute with counsel for its then top policy priority, and still one of them, privatization of Social Security, where he lays out a strategy for dividing the coalitions of groups who supported it. Talk about that, because that seemed to me to be one of places where he most clearly took the role of strategist.
Okay. So, well, you know, the funny thing is about those attacks on me, and I just had reason to write to somebody about this earlier today in relation to these revelations from GMU, but there were 101 critiques of me that emerged from the right after the book, and the researchers from Greenpeace and Uncoke My Campus produced a master tracker on this and found that 91 of those came from Koch-funded faculty members or operatives in directly Koch-funded institutions who were not declaring their own conflicts of interest, right? That's 9 out of 10, and that's not even counting the other ones where the commitment is there and the influence is indirect.
Wow.
So an irony, and a great irony is that the first guy out of the gate was this guy named Russ Roberts, who said that I should apologize to this person I had quoted at George Mason.
Yep.
And in the recent revelations from George Mason, through a FOIA request, it was revealed that Russ Roberts was chosen by a donor to be hired at George Mason. Like, that never happens ever, you know, in the academy. It was that corrupt. He was personally selected by the donor, and Tyler Cowen, the guy whose name the guy he said I had wronged, had signed off on his donor agreement, as Cowen signed off on all these other donor agreements. So anyway, it's been kind of delicious to me to see this play out, to see the kind of corruption that is coming out in these revelations and how they very much confirm the story that I was telling.
Right. And of course,
when they try to say that Buchanan was just an economist, I find that amusing because I happen to have attended a memorial conference for Buchanan at George Mason in September of 2013, where one of the Koch-funded faculty in attendance, a man named Alexander Tabarrok, said that Buchanan's genius was that he had always understood that they needed a movement. So they credit him with this kind of movement building. And I've also seen correspondence from Charles Koch's top political lieutenant who came out of George Mason, Richie Fink, in which he credited Buchanan for their shared understanding of the political economy and, you know, how important that is to their strategy. So this is just silly when they try to deflect this. But part of the problem that these George Mason people faced is that they're now using Buchanan's name to fundraise significantly in a multi-million dollar campaign for what they're calling Masonomics, which is really Buchanomics or Kochonomics.
Yeah.
And that plan was laid down. I didn't know it until my book came out, but my book came out on June 13th, and on July 4th, they renamed the Central Hall at George Mason University, Mason Hall, Buchanan Hall, in this big multi-million dollar fundraising bid. So, of course, it was terribly embarrassing and inconvenient for them that my book had this deep story of Buchanan that wasn't especially flattering or helpful to their cause. So I think that's part of the reason they've been so agitated. But as you point out, you know, the materials that I found and that I share in the book and in the endnotes and documentation for it show very clearly that Buchanan was a very strategic thinker. And the particular case you raised of Social Security illustrates that. He came back in, from Chile, which was the first nation to privatize its social security system under the Pinochet dictatorship. He came back from that to the U.S., eager to see radical changes in the U.S. Charles Koch had just moved the Cato Institute to Washington, D.C. from California in order to have more of an impact on policy. Cato later went on to hire Sebastian Piñera, who ran the privatization program of Social Security under the Pinochet dictatorship. He's still there. And in 1983, Cato decided to make Social Security privatization its number one priority, and they invited Buchanan in to advise on strategy for that. And his strategy started, and here again we circle back to your framing of all of this, that this cause is not popular. His strategy started with the recognition that there was not a single constituency in America other than libertarians and their funders who wanted to see the privatization of Social Security. And he went through all of them, neither black nor white nor brown, urban or rural, south or north, men or women, et cetera, nobody wanted this. So instead of doing what any normal citizen would do in a democracy and saying, golly, must be a good program if so many people like it, I guess we should support it. Instead, he said, therefore, those who want to radically change this, right, and undermine this program need to work in a different way. They cannot take it on frontally, right? They cannot say they want to destroy the program. Instead, they need to say they want to reform it. And mm-hmm. He actually himself put reform in quotation marks to suggest that was not the purpose. And then he laid out a multi-step strategy for undermining Social Security, first being to try to smear its reputation and say that it was unsustainable so that people would no longer feel like they could rely on it and they'd question it. And then he laid out this elaborate divide and conquer strategy for how to break apart the solid phalanx that was defending the system.
You point out no constituency was for it. When they make it about the deficit, which of course their recent tax bill shows again is a total BS, but that they also say it is bankrupt when it isn't, mm-hmm. that they also ignore the fact that if you raise the cap on where Social Security comes from, is it currently still at $114,000 of income, or has it gone up? Is it?
Maybe, oh, I don't know the best.
But I bet most people don't even know this, that your Social Security starts when you start earning money, but there is no longer Social Security deductions after you reach a certain point. It might be now around $150,000, but that means if you make $200,000, if you make $250,000, if you make $1 million, if you make $10 million, if you're et cetera,
right?
And that if that were changed, that one thing were changed, mm-hmm. and the cap raised, Social Security have no problem. But what they attempt to do, as you pointed out, saying that there was no constituency that favored it, was to pit the young against the old. And attempt to get the young to oppose Social Security. It's bankrupt. You're never going to get anything. They're just taking it away from you to give to old folks.
Yes. And another thing that they do, just to underscore how strategic all of this is one axiom of public choice thought is concentrate the idea of that they summarize as concentrated benefits, dispersed attention. And what they get at is that if you are personally connected to a program, you're going to pay more attention to it, right? And the costs of that program are going to be dispersed over a larger group so that others may not pay as much attention to it as you do. So it's harder to get rid of that program when the people who benefit from it are paying attention and others aren't really doing that because it's pennies to them. Well, so he took that principle and applied it to Social Security in the strategy I just outlined to say the first thing they had to do, in his words were, I believe, pay off the existing claims, right, or buy off the existing recipients. In other words, the people who would pay most attention to any change in Social Security would be current recipients and those about to become eligible to collect. And so he said, you buy off those people to get them out of the fight because they're going to be the most active. And then you go after these other people. But I think, you know, your listeners need to understand it's that strategic to talk about buying off parts of the coalition that would be most likely to fight. So, basically the broad outlines of what you're saying is absolutely true. And if people want good information on where Social Security is and what needs to be done to shore it up, there's a great group called Social Security Works that I highly recommend. They issue excellent research. They have a book on the subject, and they're telling the truth, unlike so many of these GOP Koch-funded elected officials.
Two things that I want you to talk about are the relationship of all of this to Trump and their plans for the Constitution.
Well, in a way, you could say they're related because Trump is the distractor in chief, right?
Yep.
You know, he gins up this never-ceasing storm of outrage that has everybody on the progressive side, following him in shock and horror, you know, with drop jaws. And meanwhile, we're not paying attention to what is going on in other places throughout the federal government, through federal departments and agencies and the courts, where this Koch agenda is moving along apace. So the Koch agenda is racing through under the Trump administration, which is not surprising because his administration is stocked with veterans of the Koch network from Vice President Mike Pence through Scott Pruitt at the EPA, through Mark Short, who's the legislative White House congressional liaison, legislative affairs director, and on and on. We don't have that many minutes, so I'm not going to go through them all, but it's really astonishing, and some really good journalists have pointed out how many seasoned Koch operatives are moving this agenda in virtually every federal department and agency at this point. And part of what they're pushing to is not only radical deregulation that would undermine the expressed will of voters over the years in things like support for clean air and water, anti-discrimination, social insurance, all those other things that we care about, radical deregulation that would, kind of use executive power to undo all that, but they are also pushing toward radical changes in the courts. And at this point, while we've all been watching Trump's tweets, he's actually made more federal judicial appointments than any recent president, in decades. And that's because of something you pointed to before, of how Mitch McConnell and the Koch-controlled or Koch-compliant Republican Party in the Senate prevented President Obama from getting hearing for his Supreme Court nominee. So they effectively stole that seat that would have gone to Merrick Garland and gave it to Neil Gorsuch. And now they've stalked the federal courts. Now, meanwhile, at the state level, through the their control over those 30 states that we talked about and the state policy network affiliates, which advise on all of that and push this agenda and work with the American Legislative Exchange Council to design legislative agendas in those states, they have now amassed 28 of the 34 states needed to convene a constitutional amendment under Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. To understand how radical that is, how astonishingly, audaciously radical that is, consider this. We have never had a state-convened constitutional convention since the document was crafted. That is because any such constitutional convention would necessarily be a runaway convention where they could do all kinds of other things. And the Koch network would be coming in with 10 already pre-considered liberty amendments to move through such a constitutional convention that would radically transform our government and the way that it has operated over the course of the 20th century in response particularly to citizen pressure. So this is hugely important. It is not getting nearly the attention it deserves. Common Cause, I will say, has done a great job of working on this and organizing against it and alerting people, but others are just not paying attention because we're all focused on the distractor-in-chief and other things. And here's the really scary thing. There are six states in which the GOP controls both houses of the legislature that have not yet authorized the Constitutional Convention.
Wait a minute. So, okay. Wait. Headline. Extra.
Yeah, right?
Danger. You're saying that they need six.
Yes, and
that
they have six.
And there are six in which they control both.
Yep. That's what I'm saying. And I actually did an op-ed about this for The Hill. If your listeners know that publication, it's a very useful publication. But if they Googled my name and Constitutional Convention in The Hill, they would find it. But it's a big deal. And I personally believe the reason the Republicans really didn't care about running the deficit up with their tax bill and with their recent budget is because that's part of the long game on this, that they will point to that deficit as a reason that we need this constitutional convention.
Mm-hmm.
Because the loss leader item, just like in a grocery store, you know, they give something away as the loss leader
right.
to get you in the store so you pay more. The loss leader item for this constitutional convention is a balanced budget amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And a balanced budget amendment polls well until people realize that it would mean the end of Social Security, Medicare, and all these other things they value.
Right.
But the Koch donor network is strategically, I believe, both creating and leveraging this mm-hmm. deficit in order to get that constitutional convention so that they can put locks and bolts in the U.S. Constitution as Buchanan helped to do in Chile.
Okay, I'm going to quote Buchanan, I believe, and if not, it's you describing his thinking, but freedom would flourish only by imposing legal and constitutional shackles that prevented public officials from responding to the will of Democratic majorities. That, I think it's your summation of one of his
yes.
tenets, but it leads you right to this notion of a constitutional convention. And the thing is that my guess is that there are many people who voted for Trump to blow things up, right? The ones who didn't necessarily agree with Trump or his character, but felt just left out, disaffected, and so on, that there are some people on the left or whatever the sort of that weird place where the far right and the far left come together that actually would go, yes, we need a constitutional convention. We're going to get rid of that Second Amendment. We're going to do this and that. When in fact, I believe, as you do, that nothing would be, as much as I hate the originalist interpretation of the Constitution we've got, you make open season on the Constitution in a country where they have been tearing down education and where wordsmithing and marketing can play such, and fake news can play such a role, this would not be the same country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it is utterly delusional to believe that the left could, you know, even moderates could prevail at such a constitutional convention. And I quite agree with you that there is a danger of this on the left because there are some people who are opposed to Citizens United, understandably, the opening of the spigots of, you know, corporate money as speech in politics
right.
to help bring us where we are. But there are some people who want this. To repeal Citizens United, and they have to be absolutely deluded about the amount of organization on the left, because there is no way that the left is organized enough to deal. And again, I mean left by anybody to the left of the libertarian
yeah,
right when
yeah.
I say that. No one is as organized as they are to be able to deal with such a constitutional convention. It should be the job of people who believe in small-d democracy everywhere to prevent that constitution at this moment in our history, and to instead focus on unrigging all of the rules that this Koch donor network and its elected allies have rigged in their favor and instead start pushing for a pro-democracy agenda of rules changes that would reverse that and enable us to renew and revive and save a democracy that is now under the most dire threat of our lifetimes.
Oh, of maybe the nation's lifetimes, or at least since maybe the 1812. Are there websites that you recommend people look? I mean, you don't seem to have one of your own. Is there something you recommend?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's so many good groups working on different aspects of this. So I mentioned Common Cause on the Constitutional Convention. I think they've been terrific. I think for people who are looking to get involved at the grassroots, you know, there's groups like the Center for Popular Democracy, Working Families Party, Greenpeace. You know, there's just, you know, the indivisible groups. There's just so much going on right now, but it's hard to put out a kind of a blanket statement when you don't know where people are based. But I would definitely say on the Constitutional Convention, Common Cause, Demos is a great source of information, many, many, many other groups are out there. Start paying attention is what I'd say. This is an all-hands-on-deck moment for the defense of our democracy. And this, what happens in the next few years is going to be absolutely decisive, like forever, frankly, because we have to consider that the planet is in the balance and that this Koch donor network does not want us to act on the threat of climate change.
Okay, so for this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencmcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. If you want to receive a weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually about 7 or 8 relevant articles, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at T.E. McNally, T.E.M.C.N.A.L.L.Y. at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes or Podomatic.com. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes or Podomatic. Listen anytime, anywhere. They include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Mark Maxwell in production and George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Nancy McLean. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence. You keep up the good work, too. It's amazing.